got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. Kevin, what's going on? How are you?
Everything is peachy. Having fun teaching molecular biology class. Good times. Whole new fresh crop of students. And we're having a good time. Despite the fact that we're living in a virus-saturated state, we're laminating ourselves and taking a Silkwood shower right after, and it comes out great.
Crazy stuff, man. I'm going to brave a concert tomorrow. So we'll see. I don't know.
In sync in town?
How'd you know? No, I'm going to go see Korn, which is one of my favorite rock bands. So it'll be fun. I'm fully vaccinated and it's outside. So if I get sick, then whatever. It was worth it.
That's a Korn with a C or a K. Which one?
A backwards K.
Okay, yeah, yeah. The one with the C is not that good.
Is that a musical act? I just thought it was a mildly sweet vegetable of some kind.
No, very good.
All right, well, let's jump into our stories and see if we can talk about a little science here on this lovely afternoon. So, first up, alarmism undermines public support to fight climate change and alienates young people. So says this individual writing for GLP. We'll get into those arguments in just a second. Next up, should we aim for harm reduction or absolute safety? Herbal supplement Kratom puts FDA risk calibration to the test. And finally, OMG, GMO, killer ice cream? Here's the latest in anti-biotechnology hysteria. That's a pretty terrific headline. I dig that. But first up, let's talk about alarmism and climate change, Kevin.
Well, the theme for today is hysteria, right? And I mean, it is. And this first one is about alarmism. And really, it just boils down to the old story of what was the story about the kid and the wolf? What was that story called where he keeps saying the wolf has got me and then no one comes and gets him because what's that story called?
I don't know. Just Crying Wolf. I know that's what that's called.
Oh, Crying. Yeah. So it's about a Crying Wolf. The basic idea is that when you have climate alarmism, which is what we get from the IPCC, that it tends to have a negative effect on the attitudes of especially young people. That's not hard to believe because the IPCC is doing a service. They really are consulting the best in scientific expertise. I'm confident that they're correct. I have no problems with the climate change discussion, other than I do get a little bit touchy when we start talking about the hockey stick, right? You know, the sharp extremism, because two reasons. One is that these processes are slow. They're geological, practically, in terms of one's lifetime. So someone who's a student or whatever, they're probably not terribly freaked out about it because it's going to affect them when they're some years down the road, you know, not a big deal. We'll deal with it later. The other problem is that those claims of catastrophic events, when they don't come true, backlash. So you even hear people now talking about Al Gore's first movie, Inconvenient Truth, about how they said the world would be underwater by 2018 and never happened. So you start to erode the trust in the folks who are making the predictions. And then the trust in the predictions, which just are happening at a slower pace. And so Jason Reed in this article in The Mirror really talked about how this is the problem, that you're showing that there are problems that are likely to be huge and tragic and all of this, but it isn't really affecting them that much, and it's happening over a long time. It's like the other story of the you shouldn't do that. Well, stop me when I need glasses, right? That's kind of the essence of his particular argument.
Now, wasn't there a study, I think it was just a few months ago, it was in Science or one of the bigger journals, that more or less said this? I think, if I understood it correctly, the argument was, we're pretty good at predicting these general trends in terms of CO2 emissions and, you know, the climate warming up, but these hard and fast dates, like you were just saying, we cannot, or at least we don't have the technology or the scientific understanding to really do that. And so we have to stop putting these dates on it. Do you remember that?
Okay. No, you're right on it. The basic idea is that there's too many factors at play. And when you start making predictions that don't come true, then you start to lose the trust of the folks who need to hear the predictions. It also can be used as a political weapon to say, well, you know, look at so-and-so as wrong. You know, again, the big problem is that a lot of these a lot of the concern around this is that the alarmism seems to hit the poor a little harder. And that was the other big part of the article, was that when you start to talk about mitigation strategies, and one of them was, you know, maybe higher costs on fossil fuels or airplane flights or whatever, that now starts to really affect the poor. And that's where we really start to get into these things, and where the discussions of climate really are super unproductive.
Yeah, that's a whole nother aspect of the debate that I don't think people consider very often. So one of the things, and you'll hear this from a lot of people on the skeptical side, they'll say, you need to let people burn fossil fuels because that's the key to developing their economies. And once they develop their economies, they're going to be able to enact some of these mitigation strategies, and they'll be more concerned about the environment because they're not hungry and they have clean water and they have medicine. And in other words, they'll be in a circumstance like the United States is, or at least closer to it. And then they'll actually try to solve the problem. But right now they're, you know, they're burning animal poop for food, and they're just, you know, living in really impoverished conditions in some parts of the world. And so the idea that you're just going to tell them, yeah, like, yeah, no more gasoline, it seems a little impractical.
Yeah, that's true. And really the thing is, it's also very, I don't know, I guess it's a little bit arrogant and kind of nation-centric, because the fact is that the climate is not a economy. It's not one nation's problem. This is a global problem, and the nations that are in the best position to solve the problem are the ones that should be doing that. And this is where we really, what we learned a lot about communicating around the risk of climate change, is that you don't use fear and drama to motivate people to take action. You couch it in technology and leadership. That instead of saying that you know, this is going to be a disaster if we don't, and if you don't sacrifice, and if you don't pay a carbon tax, the better way to do this is to say, we're going to use this as an opportunity. Since we work, you know, are in the industrialized world and a world leading economy, we're going to leverage that wealth and those resources to develop strategies that we can then deploy to the developing world so that they can accelerate their economies faster using cleaner technologies, that we're going to be the leaders in creating a carbon-free economy. That's the way that you do this. And that's the way that you change people's hearts and minds, because you take their brains out of blame and here's why you're a problem, to here's how we're going to work together to solve this crisis by creating new economies based upon newer technologies.
But before we move on, going back to the alarmism issue for a second, how much of this is the fault of, I guess, some academic institutions and some non-governmental agencies like the IPCC? Because when you read the academic literature, and I think you were getting at this earlier, Kevin, when you read the literature itself, it's very conservative in terms of what it predicts. And it's very methodical in explaining what they looked at and how they looked at it and so forth. But then when you're trying to get attention for your research, or you're, you know, you're a reporter and you're trying to get eyeballs, you're going to blow that up out of proportion. The reason I ask is I see this in agricultural research. I see it in, you know, the lab grown meat sphere, all that, you know, in 5 years, we're going to have, you know, prime rib that was grown in the lab and that kind of thing. So in other words, that's a long winded way of asking, to what extent is this our fault? Kevin, as science communicators.
Yeah, huge. But it's also a big problem of university communications departments that sometimes will overstep the data a little bit. So whereas the researcher does a good job, that it gets a few extra ornaments to kind of sell it when it, once it goes through a university's communications machine. Different universities are great, other ones not so good. I can just point to examples where that's the case. In other cases, it is definitely a question of the science reporters, the ones who know that if it bleeds, it leads. And you know, we've seen plenty of examples of that. So that's really the big deal, is a glacier melting over 34 years doesn't make headlines. But more immediate effects of that might. So it's the extrapolations are sometimes a little bit too familiar.
Well, in the same vein, let's talk about kratom and drug regulation. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting example of how you balance the approval or the use or the regulation of a psychoactive compound, or I guess a psychoactive plant that contains different compounds, that how do you regulate it, especially when people are using it? Kratom, for folks who are unfamiliar with this thing, is what this is. It's a plant, or it's, I guess it's called a plant. It's a really lousy name for a plant. it sounds like it would smell bad. I was back weed whacking the kratom. It's Mitrogyna speciosa. It's a plant that produces opioid-like compounds. And the idea is that people use this stuff as a substitute for opioids. It's something that you can buy in a health food store. It's a supplement. And it makes a number of compounds that interact. Well, it has a number of compounds that are psychoactive, some that work as opioid agonists and others that are stimulants. And between the two, it's supposed to be one of these, you know, supposed to have some reasonable effects in mitigating pain, stress, anxiety, all that stuff. And now you can buy it in the health food stores. You know, the big problem nowadays, of course, is the opioid epidemic, the pervasiveness of street fentanyl. And kratom is something that people turn to as an alternative. And when you get to that, now all of a sudden, it opens up a new regulatory cascade as to, is this something that should be regulated as a drug? Are there real addiction and dependency issues? And what do we do now? And that's really the big question.
You know, this just could be my perspective, not knowing how this all works, but the way the FDA has reacted to this, it seems like they're like, oh, we're not regulating this yet. We should start doing that. And it becomes this sort of mission creep where it's like, well, we're not doing this and maybe we should be. So people think that we're taking, drug control or drug prohibition seriously. And it's not really connected to the facts on the ground. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it's hard to tell because, you know, this is because of the fact that it has opioid-like effects, it probably should have some layer of control. And here's the deal. Like kratom, when you're talking about the plant as a supplement, the stuff that's in plants and a plant leaf, you don't know exactly what's in there because it hasn't necessarily been tested. And, you know, plants will develop secondary metabolites based upon genetics and also soil conditions and fertilizer and water and sunlight and all the things that make a plant do what a plant does. And so when you're consuming leaves of a plant for medicinal quality, you don't know how much of that dose you're delivering. So there is a good argument that maybe purifying out the active substances and then maybe using those and regulating those may make more sense than the plant itself. You know, at the same time, it's one of these things that, you know, on the other hand, it's a plant that you can grow. And if people are getting benefit from it without use of a physician or a prescription, then why is anyone, you know, going back to the medical marijuana argument, you know, let them do it.
Yeah, that seems to make sense to me. And in this article we're talking about, they cited a study that the CDC did. And they said that the kratom use was responsible for less than 1% of overdose deaths. And even in those cases, people were using really dangerous drugs like illicit fentanyl that you get off the street, and that if you sniff it, sometimes it can kill you. So in other words, it seems like this issue needs to be judged on a scale. So maybe it has opioid like effects, but that doesn't make it Vicodin, you know? So in other words, I don't know. It seems like you can approach this with a certain level of, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but you can take a balanced perspective on this.
There's nuance. There's nuance. And I get that, but you know, but this is one of the things that drives me nuts is that we shouldn't be self-medicating with anything. And probably even could say that about alcohol and other things that people use that are perfectly legal and not, you know, overly regulated by the FDA. How do you, you know, you can buy it in a restaurant. You know, that people who are using substances for medication or for self-medication without understanding dose and without understanding a physician's guidance, you know, that's probably where we need to really be thinking about the kratom question. And lots of scientists are working on this idea of identifying these types of opiates and opiate antagonists and other types of compounds that are secondary metabolites similar to opioids, and studying how plants can be made to make more of them, or how we can get a plant to make different species or combinations that can then be purified and understood with their dosage. There's a scientist, Ian Graham at the John Innes, I think is where he is, who's doing this kind of work. And I need to get him on Talking Biotech because it's really, really intriguing stuff.
Yeah, very good. One final thought, I think, is that this too contributes to that lack of trust that a huge segment of the public has in the scientific or the medical establishment, because, you know, I've never used this, but presumably a lot of people use this. And the FDA is doing the same thing with electronic cigarettes too, to use another example. And I use one of those so I don't smoke the real things. It's very good for my health relative to tobacco. And they're doing the same kind of thing in my mind. They're over-regulating it and they're exaggerating a threat. And it's not helpful. So people see this happen, and in many cases, it impacts their well-being. So when it comes to vaccines or it comes to social distancing or whatever, they just go, well, you know, you guys are full of crap on the thing I know a lot about. So why would I trust you on this? It does, you know, I don't know. There's downstream effects is all I'm getting at.
No, you're exactly right. It just is one more thing that whether you have controversy where controversy doesn't necessarily need to exist. And there is a place where everybody can kind of rally around here. The idea is how do you give people relief from pain without the problems that can come about from opioids? And maybe that's the conversation that needs to be had. There is a national or American Kratom Association. which, all right, you know, someone can grow this thing and make some money off it, but it's one of these things that I think that because it has potentially addictive qualities, maybe it is something that there needs to be some regulation, but with much more nuance.
Right on. Well, speaking of things that are not a public health threat, GMO ice cream, not going to kill you.
Yeah, so tell us about this, because you wrote the story in the ACSH website. So what do you got?
So I came across this a few weeks ago, and it was an activist who's very, well, a food lawyer, I guess is what I should call her. But this was originally an article that I found in the Organic and Non-GMO Report, which is a pretty prominent, at least in that circle, a pretty prominent website for that kind of commentary. And they were raising concern about ice cream that's made in the laboratory. At least some of its key ingredient, which is a dairy protein, is made in the lab instead of getting it from cow's milk. And so they were raising all sorts of concerns about people not knowing that they're being exposed to a food allergen and it's deceptive labeling. And we don't, and this is, Michelle Simon, this is, these are her words, and that's the lawyer who they quoted in this article. She said, lives are on the line. And so I just had to respond to this, and we can get into the details, Kevin, but it's just, it's really dumb that people really say these things.
Well, what's the deal with the ice cream though? So let's go back to that kind of thing. Now, because this is one of these new synthetic foods. We've talked about this a little bit.
Yeah. And frankly, the technology itself is not new. I mean, you use roughly the same process to make insulin, to make the main ingredient for a lot of drugs, including a lot of vaccines, the plant-based Impossible Burger. It just basically involves moving a gene from where it normally is found into some kind of a microbe where you can mass produce it. And then you can make whatever product, whether it's a medicine or a food. We've been doing this for decades. And for them to raise this concern now about this product, because frankly, it's some kind of a threat to their market share, is just silly. You know, there's no, a protein is a protein as long as it's a protein, as I wrote in the article. It's silly to try to make some kind of distinction between them.
Yeah, I think this is, I can't remember the name of the company now, but it was the, who makes the milk? There's a company that makes the milk-like product. Gosh, I'm trying to remember the name of it now. But anyway, they basically make milk, but there's no milk in it. It's all the chemistry of milk that's derived from microorganisms and then assembled into milk.
Perfect day.
That's it. So you can't tell the difference between milk and that with just about any level of analysis, because it's the same mixture. And you just don't use a cow to get it. And so this is the beauty of this. And it's more of it you'll see. This may be their pioneer product.
Yeah. And it's, I just like any kind of cool use of technology because it's awesome. I don't know. Maybe that sounds circular, but to the specific threat of food allergens, this was probably the most susceptible part of the article. Speaking of the FDA again, they mandate that if there's a potential allergen in a food product, you have to put a label on it and you have to say, warning, contains peanuts or contains soy or contains milk, whatever. You know, there's a list of 7 or 8 major allergens, and dairy is included on that list. And even if the product doesn't contain or necessarily contain the allergen, if it could, then companies are encouraged to put a label on it. You know what I'm saying? So this is really misleading the way they frame this.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what, it's what you can expect. You know, the thing for me is I get more excited about, like you said, get more excited about these new innovations. I don't see them as a threat to animal agriculture or to traditional food. I see them as more options that expand the ability for people to have access to different products. And prices will eventually come down. These things will be scaled. It's going to be a really interesting time.
So the other thing that kind of bugs me about this, Kevin, is that it treats consumers like they're stupid, especially if they have food allergies. You know, the idea that someone is unable to check a food label or if they have a potential health risk from eating foods, that they aren't capable of making this decision for themselves. And it's especially annoying because all of these people advocate for the non-GMO project label, which explicitly says on the website, at least, we cannot guarantee that these products are non-GMO. You know, so it's like, you're fine with certain deceptive labels. And that's why I said earlier, this seems like it's a gimmick. This is designed to protect market share and not really, it's not concerned about public health.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Your point about people who have allergies check labels for allergies or figure out what something is before they eat it totally makes sense. And it drives me crazy when they have drug commercials and they'll say, don't take acyclovir if you're allergic to acyclovir. Well, no shit, Sherlock. You know, it's such a strange thing that they say, don't take things you're allergic to.
Yeah. And you know, they're required to say that, you know, federal laws.
I know, but
yeah. But in other words, in this case, you know, for her to try to stir up controversy about it on that basis is kind of silly. And the reality is, it's like, this is made for, there's a novelty aspect to it. You know, I'll start eating this when it becomes available around me. just because it's, oh, you know, why not? A burger made of plants, ice cream made without cows, or at least indirectly, you know. Uh-huh. But I think the primary marketing angle for this long term is for vegans and for people that have ethical concerns about eating animal products. You know, this is, or at least it's designed to get people to go that way, I think. That's another aspect to this. So it's not even really related to food safety in any way.
Yeah, yeah. But then the other beautiful part of this, though, is it shows another way to make food and things that you recognize and things that are traditional and things that are part of our social functions, but make it in a different way. And could places that don't have cattle be able to have milk and cheese and ice cream, which ice cream is very good. and so there's all these other interesting ways that this opens the door to so many other options, and getting people connected with food is really important, and it's something that I really want to fight for. So more options on the table, the better.
Yeah, really good point. And a more global perspective, I suppose, you know, that this makes a lot of sense for places where maybe you can't get dairy for whatever reason.
That's right.
Good stuff. All right, Kevin, who are you following on Twitter?
I don't know if this is a duplicate. We've been doing this for a year, like the who you're following thing. And so I don't know who, you know, if we keep repeating, but if we do, then follow them again. Give them a double follow.
I follow Steakum at steak, STEAK underscore UMM. And Steakum is one of the wisest, most insightful meat products on the internet. And I would really urge you, if you don't follow Steakum already, which you probably do, you need to follow Steakum. It's brilliant. How about you?
Well, let me say that is a duplicate, but it's a terrific duplicate. I don't know why. I just love anybody who dunks on Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's really smart. He's done a lot for science communication. Get me wrong, but there's this trend in a lot of the sci-com world. There's just a certain smugness that goes with being a celebrity. You know, like, I'm a scientist and I can crack jokes, and they were not impressed by that. So, anyways, that's a great follow. But I'm going to recommend people follow the makers of the documentary that ACSH is releasing. We did an interview with the director and the host of it a couple weeks back, but it's called Big Fears, Little Risks. And it's on Twitter at Big Fears Inc. And it's cool because at least what we're trying to do is to turn it into a documentary series. So we're going to do the first one, which is like 36 minutes, and it covers all the topics we cover on the show. But moving forward, you know, there'll be more issues to discuss in the science world, trying to get people on board with what the facts actually say. So at Big Fears Inc. on Twitter. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us as always. Have a terrific week or weekend or whatever day it is for you. You can follow Kevin and I as well at Kevin Foltz on Twitter, at ACSH Org on Twitter. And my website is CameronJEnglish.net. Thank you so much. And we will see you next week.